to speak at your workshop, which so far is very interesting. So I'm going to be talking on a subject that maybe a bit less than half of the people in this room have already heard me speak about at some point in the past. I speak about it relatively often, but the other half of you haven't. And so I'm going to give a lengthy introduction to sort of the big picture. And I apologize for those of you who have seen that introduction before. But I tried to make the second half of the talk have some new stuff in it. And so I urge people to wait for the second half if you've seen some of these things before. There will be some connection with what we heard this morning. I'll be talking about uncertainty principles a fair bit. And I should say that I'm happy for everyone to interrupt me with your questions as we're going along. Perhaps rather than waiting to the end, just ask me and I'll answer them as I go, and maybe just speak a bit longer. Okay, this is my rough map of what the landscape of foil theories to quantum mechanics looks like. We're going to be talking over here. No. Yeah, the problem with the subsets. Don't take the subset seriously. It didn't really work out. That's why it's a background on my title slide rather than an actual slide in my talk. Yeah. A possibilistic theory is a probabilistic theory. Is like a probabilistic theory, but instead of having probabilities, you just have impossible and possible. So it's sort of all it has is modal logic. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to say was that there are broadly two approaches to reconstruction or axiomatization, and Lucien made reference to a distinction like the one I want to mention here. The distinction is, I don't know how to describe it, but I'll characterize it as an operational versus an ontological approach. So an operational approach to axiomatization, I would say, is an approach wherein the primitives of description are experimental operations. So things like preparation procedures and measurement procedures, and the axioms or the principles that you use are described in those terms. So for example, if you said that the world is the kind of place where one can't solve NP-complete problems efficiently, well, that is an operational description of a principle, and so I would put it here. Ultimately, whether you can solve NP-complete problems efficiently is a matter of whether you can build devices which you set along a course which will give you certain outputs. It's sort of an input-output relationship. And I think we're going to hear a lot of talks at this conference that are squarely over here, where we start with a very general operational framework and we impose restrictions. And so you can think of the constraints as being ultimately a constraint on the probabilities for outcomes of measurements given preparations. A different kind of approach, which I'll call an ontological approach, is one where your principles or your axioms put constraints on the ontology of the world and its dynamics, which is very different. So here we're talking about anthropomorphic things. Over here we're talking about possibly microscopic, very abstract things. And so I put some pictures of Conway's Game of Life up as a nice way of capturing that. You know, there you have an ontology of cells that are either on or off, and a dynamical rule, and all sorts of structures emerge. And so you can imagine that as your postulates for trying to derive a physical theory. This talk is going to be in the latter category. I'm going to try to, well, it's sort of an incomplete project, but it's an attempt to reconstruct quantum theory starting from claims about ontology and dynamics. So this is very broadly what I want to convince you of, which is that if you start with a classical framework, so it's a classical ontology, and you consider a statistical theory, so probability distributions over your classical state space, and then you add a principle that says there's a fundamental restriction on what kinds of statistical distributions can be prepared, then you can derive a large part of quantum theory. And I'll specify what I mean by a large part, ultimately. The sense in which you derive it is that you can reproduce the operational predictions of that part of quantum theory. And what emerges from this approach is that non-orthogonal quantum states end up being statistical distributions that have some overlap. And throughout the talk, I'm going to refer to statistical distributions as epistemic states or states of knowledge, because if you have a system that's drawn from some ensemble of possible states, then that distribution can either describe the ensemble, or I can say it describes my knowledge of an individual that was drawn from that ensemble. And I'm going to use those two languages interchangeably. Okay, so that's the big picture. There are many different places in which you can apply this strategy. So generically, you start with the classical theory. You can start with mechanics. And then you consider the statistical theory of that classical theory. So in the case of mechanics, we often refer to that theory as Liouville mechanics. This is the theory of what sorts of distributions you can prepare over the classical state space, and if you have a dynamics for the classical states, how do the distributions change over time? If I do a measurement, how do those distributions get updated, and so forth. That's all part of Liouville mechanics. And then the theory I'll be interested in is what I'll call a restricted statistical theory for the classical theory. And so I'm going to impose a certain kind of restriction on the sorts of distributions, and I'll call that restricted Liouville mechanics. And what I hope to show you is that this theory is equivalent to something called Gaussian quantum mechanics, which is a part of quantum mechanics. You can do the same thing for a different sort of classical theory, a classical theory of bits. So these are the simplest discrete systems you could imagine. They're just two classical state systems. And so here it's sort of harder to imagine what the dynamics look like. So I like to think of this as a computation. You have a whole number of bits, and then dynamics is maybe these two bits go through a gate. They get coupled together, and their final states depend on their initial states. And I can imagine coupling any number of bits together through gates. The statistical theory of bits is just a theory of the probability distributions over the possible strings that could describe the state of those bits, and how they evolve under these gates, and what happens to them as I do measurements and so forth. And then the theory I'll be interested in imposes a restriction on what kinds of statistical distributions there are. And if you impose the restriction in a particular way, what you find is that this theory comes out to be almost precisely, but not quite, something called the stabilizer theory for qubits, which is a sub-theory of the full quantum theory of qubits, which is used in quantum information theory.
Are you going to explain how it's not exactly?
Yes, we'll get to that. You can do the same thing with three-level classical systems, which I'll call TRITs, following the information theorists. You can define a statistical theory of TRITs. You can impose a restriction in a particular way. And what you get turns out to be precisely equivalent to the stabilizer theory for Q-TRITs. So on the one hand, you might say, well, that's not very impressive, because these theories are essentially, in a certain sense, linear. You might say, well, they're not a particularly big subset of quantum theory. Maybe you think these kinds of things are boring. You know, Gaussians are boring. But in defense of this accomplishment, let me just point out how many quantum phenomena you get in these theories. So your basic quantum phenomena, such as non-commutativity of observables, interference, coherent superposition, collapse of the wave function, the existence of complementary bases, a no-cloning theorem, and so on, all exist within the stabilizer theories and Gaussian quantum mechanics. It's also true that most quantum information processing tasks, like teleportation and key distribution and so on, exist within these theories. A large part of entanglement theory is there. And a large part of the abstract formalism, things like the Choi-Gel-Minkowski isomorphism, the Neymar extension, the Steinspring dilation, the fact that there are many convex decompositions of a mixed state, and the list goes on. So for that reason, I think this is a really interesting subset of quantum theory, because a lot of the stuff that usually one might think is non-classical and somehow surprising exists in this part of quantum mechanics. Yes? Yeah, that's exactly the sort of argument I want to make, that I wouldn't say they become classical features, but rather you can sort of have a hierarchy of non-classicality. There's sort of easy non-classicality, stuff that you can get with a very small departure from a classical theory. And then there's hard non-classicality, stuff that's truly a departure from classical theory, according to this way of thinking about things. So I should say that this approach, what we're really asking is, what is special about quantum mechanics, not from any old point of view, but rather from a classical standpoint, right? If you are a classical physicist, you know, what's the minimum I would have to tell you, add to what you know, to get quantum theory? So this is sort of pointing out that a lot of quantum mechanics can be obtained from this extra ingredient, which is a restriction on what you can know about the classical state. So this is sort of what's been accomplished so far. Where are we going with this? Well, you can do the same sort of thing for optics. Actually, this is a straightforward extension of the case of mechanics. There's a well-known theory of statistical optics. If you add a restriction, you get something that's precisely equivalent to linear quantum optics, which includes a large set of interesting quantum optical experiments. You can try to play the same game with electrodynamics. There has been some work on statistical electrodynamics. I don't mean stochastic electrodynamics. I mean just the theory of having a lack of information about electrodynamic fields. And then you can add a restriction. And this hasn't been done, but what I anticipate is that I might get something which is a part of quantum electrodynamics, possibly exactly equal to that part or approximately equal. And then finally, you could imagine trying to play the same game with general relativity, get a statistical theory. And as I understand it, we don't really have a good statistical version of GR currently. That is a theory which describes lack of information about gravitational degrees of freedom. And you can add a restriction on knowledge and see what comes out. Yeah, I don't anticipate you would get the full theory of quantum gravity, because nowhere along here do you get the full theory, but you might get an interesting part of it. The other thing that this does for you is it allows you to categorize quantum phenomena into those which do arise in these sorts of restricted statistical classical theories and those that don't. And that could be considered a hierarchy of kinds of non-classicality. So here I wrote down a whole bunch of qualitative quantum phenomena, which are often pointed to as puzzling features, non-classical features. And if you sort them, you find that, at least for this list, the larger number end up in this column here. You can get non-commutativity and entanglement and collapse and so forth within these sorts of theories. But there are some that stand out, in particular Bell inequality violations, the Bell quotient spectra theorem, and other proofs of contextuality of quantum theory, quantum computational speedups, if indeed they exist in the computation complexity sense. And I would also add certain aspects of items on the left. When I write something down here, I mean there's a way of describing this phenomena in terms of certain qualitative features, which people point to and say that's why the phenomena is surprising. And the claim is that those aspects can be reproduced in these sorts of theory. But maybe if you point to a more subtle aspect of the phenomena, that you might say, oh, well, you know, instead of focusing on the thing that most people say is weird, what if you focus on this very particular aspect of it, then it might land over here. I'm sorry? No broadcasting? No broadcasting would be over here. These sorts of theories have no broadcasting theories.
Why do you have those signals?
Well, I guess, yeah, it's just a bit of pedantry. Bell inequality violations by themselves aren't surprising unless you're working in a framework where you don't have signaling. So I'd say it's really the combination of those two things that is mysterious. So that's why I put them together. There are phenomena that are outstanding. I don't know how to categorize them. Things like quantized spectra, fermionic particle statistics. Right now, fermionic particle statistics is my best candidate for something I can add to the list on the right. And that's really what I want to do, because according to this a way of approaching things. The stuff on the left isn't so mysterious, and the stuff on the right still appears very surprising. And so you'd like to find more of these and focus on them to try to develop this sort of research program. So, what is the research program? Let me try to put it into a broader framework. So there are many people, and probably many people in this room, who would agree that quantum theory is best understood as a kind of probability theory. Here are a few references for that, as opposed to, you know, a theory of reality, as opposed to, you know, it's a theory of how we should reason, as opposed to a theory of ontology. And furthermore, there are many people who would say that quantum states are states of incomplete knowledge, where something is unknown. But this research program is taking a slightly different view, or it's going a bit further, and it's saying it's, that knowledge is of a deeper reality. It's of an ontology. It's not knowledge of the outcomes of future experiments. It's knowledge of perhaps some microscopic degrees of freedom.
Is that necessary to your research program? I know you talk about that.
Why is it
necessary?
Well, it's not necessary in the sense that I could imagine progress being made without that assumption. But personally, I think this is an avenue worth pursuing. I think by deciding to focus on, you know, there has to be an ontology, there has to be a clear distinction between what you know and what is real, I think that's a very useful exercise. So rather than you know, following mathematical generalization and coming up with, you know, a theory that I don't know how to interpret, the idea here is let's try to be very conservative about the interpretation and see how far we can get. And I think the reason it's worthwhile is that ultimately I want an interpretation of the quantum formalism that isn't just operational. I'm not happy saying quantum mechanics is about what happens in the lab when I do this and then I do that. So I'm ultimately, and we could have a long discussion about why I'm unhappy about operationalism, but that's really my motivation.
Right, I understand that. I guess I'm asking something more specific, which is, if you get rid of that, if you allow for it not to actually be the reality, does that screw up your program? Is it necessary? I mean, I know you like it.
Well, let's put it this way. Suppose you derive the quantum formalism, but along the way, you know, you said, oh, well, I had to give up the notion that this was knowledge of reality. It's something else. It's knowledge of something else. Then I would ask you, well, what's it knowledge of? And if your answer is something like the outcomes of future experiments, then I say, okay, well, you've now given me an operational derivation of quantum theory, which is nice. We can understand where quantum theory comes from in terms of these operational constraints. But it might not be so helpful for me to come up with a realist interpretation. So my claim, I guess, in the background is that if we have a reconstruction of quantum theory that starts from ontological claims, then that will be more helpful to us in deriving a realist interpretation than a reconstruction from operational claims. Actually, I think both will be helpful. If we had, you know, really good reconstructions on the operational side, I think that will be helpful for interpretations. My gut feeling, though, is that we also need to pursue this other program, the ontological program,
okay, well, I guess maybe it's more that you like the idea that if you have knowledge of something.
So here I'm sort of presuming that we agree that, you know, the distinction between knowledge and the thing about which you have knowledge is a useful distinction to keep in mind, lest we get totally conceptually confused. We have the epistemology-ontology omelet otherwise. So I think that I would say, you know, you really have to keep that distinction in mind, no matter what that knowledge is about.
I know that we cannot resolve the question now, but I feel kind of striking when I saw the two columns
yes.
on the previous slide, that what is left on the right,
yep.
in the right-hand column, was sort of genuinely quantum and cannot be explained in terms of the electricity. Are precisely those theories, like Bell theorem and quantum spectral theorem, that point at the non-existence of the
So, I take exception with that particular way of characterizing the significance of Bell's theorem and the quotient Speckler theorem. I think really what they say, you know, Bell's theorem says, you know, there's no pre-existing local reality. And I would say the Cochin-Specker theorem says that there's no non-contextual hidden variable model. That doesn't mean there isn't a hidden variable model. It just means there isn't a particular kind of hidden variable model. So I think when people jump to the conclusion there's no pre-existing reality, that's one conclusion too far. It's not warranted from those theorems.
And there is a model. And there exists a hidden variable model.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you could start saying, you know, what do I think that deeper reality has to look like? I suppose I could say, well, it's clearly not a local non-contextual hidden variable model. That won't work. But, you know, what is it exactly? If I say to you it's a non-local hidden variable model, then you'll probably have a particular picture of what I mean. You might think that Rob thinks that if you change something here, instantaneously something changes over here. Personally, I don't think that kind of model is very promising. Good. Yes. So in that sense, I do believe in that we have to look for those kinds of models. If you really press me, I'll start saying some very vague things about relationalism, and maybe we'll get to that at the end, what my speculations are about where to go. Other questions? Okay, so here's the speculative possibility for an axiomatization of quantum theory. Principle one would be that there's a fundamental restriction on observers' capacities to know and control the systems around them. That's the epistemic restriction. I think it's worth saying and control. I think we have to think of these observers not just as observers, but as agents as well. And then the second principle, I don't know what it's going to be, but it clearly has to be some change to the classical picture of the world, because a local, non-contextual hidden variable model won't work. So here I don't really know how to proceed. I think it's still worthwhile to look for possibilities for principle two, even if only in the context of toy theories, even if you don't really get all the way to quantum mechanics. I think it's very fruitful to ask, what could you add here such that you get something that looks anything like Bell inequality violations or a Cochin-Specker theorem? I think it's necessary that you derive principle one from principle two, or some set of principles that supplement it. Remember when I said I want an ontological reconstruction, you know, the principles were supposed to be axioms about ontology and its dynamics. And this principle doesn't look like such an axiom. It's an axiom about observers. Observers are macroscopic things. So how does that jive with the constraint earlier? My response is that, yeah, this is just a stepping stone towards a better principle. So this principle gets me pretty far. And what I hope is that by modeling observers as physical systems, you know, our brains are physical systems, computing devices, perhaps certain claims about ontology and dynamics could be used to justify a claim that any agent in the world is going to be limited in how much information they can gather about the systems around them. Okay, so what am I going to do today? Well, I mentioned that there's these three different areas in which I've been working on adding an epistemic restriction. And previously, those three, I had three very different looking restrictions, right? So I had sort of custom-made epistemic restrictions for each of these three contexts. And so that's a bit worrying, because it's unclear that, you know, there's it would be much nicer, let me say, if you had just one epistemic restriction which could be applied in each of these three contexts, and it would just take a different form, and you'd get these theories coming out. And so that's what I want to talk about today, is basically an epistemic restriction that does that. It's just one form of restriction applied to these three different cases. Unfortunately, it doesn't get me precisely what I have advertised. It gives me quadrature quantum mechanics rather than Gaussian quantum mechanics. So quadrature quantum mechanics is just the name I've given to Gaussian quantum mechanics, where you restrict yourself to states that are infinitely squeezed. And I'll define it more precisely later on. So the project of getting these three theories, which approximate parts of quantum mechanics, the original ones, the Gaussian quantum mechanics plus the other two, that's still ongoing. I don't have a generic form of epistemic restriction that will get me all three of those, although Olaf Schreiber, the student who's working with me on this, and I have made some progress on that front. Today, I'm only able to do something a bit less ambitious, which is to show that all three of these theories can be derived from a single kind of epistemic restriction. Okay, so that's the end of the general introduction. Let me tell you about the restriction. So I'm going to call it classical complementarity. So as I said, this is joint work with Olaf, and it's really building upon a lot of different threads. So this is some early work I did on a statistically restricted theory for bits. Stephen Van Enck wrote a paper on how to generalize this to D-level systems, so we're building on that. David Gross, this is a very critical paper for what I'm doing, worked on discrete Wigner representations for trits and discrete systems. And also there's an unpublished paper by Steve Bartlett and Terry Rudolph and I on the continuous variable case. And so all these things are kind of put together into this talk in an order that doesn't represent how they were discovered. Okay, so what is classical complementarity? Here's the guiding idea. Here's a fact about operational quantum theory. The observables that are jointly measurable are those that form a commuting set. They're commuting relative to the matrix commutator. So we want a notion of when things can be jointly known. What things can I know simultaneously? So it took Olaf and I a very long time. We studied all kinds of discrete versions of the uncertainty principle. And after a long time, we came up with this very simple idea, which worked, which is the restriction could be that the jointly knowable classical variables are simply a commuting set of variables, where now commutation is defined relative to the Poisson bracket. That's it. So let me tell you about that in detail. So I'll start by reviewing classical mechanics. So I'm going to imagine just n classical continuous degrees of freedom. They form a configuration space. So Q1 is the position of the first system up to the position of the nth system. And I can define a phase space. Maybe I should move over here. I can define a phase space in terms of these. I'm going to denote a point in the phase space just by M. And now I can define functionals on the phase space. So these will be my variables. And I can define a Poisson bracket for those. So the Poisson bracket of functionals F and G at phase space point M is just this familiar beast here. And I'm going to look in particular at the linear functionals. This is going to be important. So I'll call these the canonical variables. They're just the linear combinations of the position and momenta of the various systems. And they form a dual space to my phase space. Yeah. So I'm going to use capital letters to denote the functionals and small letters to denote points in the phase space. So I have switched from Q's to capital X's. Sorry about that. It is too much work to change all the other slides to Q's. But you see the distinction that the capital letters are functionals over the phase space. So they're maps from the phase space to the reals, where these are just coordinates.
So
that functional which returns to you, if you acted on M, it returns Q1.
Okay.
And P1 is the functional acting on M returns P1 and so on. So these functionals, by the Ritz representation theorem, form a vector space. And it's the dual space to my phase space. So it's also R to the 2n. And so I'm going to denote the vector in that dual space by exactly the same notation I used to denote the functional itself. And I hope that doesn't cause confusion. And now here's a key observation, which is that the Poisson bracket of two functionals acting on a phase space point is the symplectic inner product of the associated vectors in the dual space. So remember that the Poisson bracket asked me to, you know, take derivatives with respect to Q and V. So if I these should be capital XI and capital PI. That's a mistake. So if I put in a particular function here and I start taking these derivatives, I'll pull out the appropriate coefficients, and it'll turn out that it will be precisely this expression, the vector F and the vector G, with this symplectic matrix in between, such that this is not the regular Euclidean product, but the symplectic inner product. So for example, if F is just, AB and G is CD, then this is AD minus BC. Okay, so this means that instead of talking about Poisson brackets of the functionals, I can always talk about the symplectic inner product of the associated vectors, and I can have a geometric picture of these functionals. So what happens when you look at discrete degrees of freedom? Because in the talk, I'm going to be considering continuous and these two different kinds of discrete degrees of freedom. Everything's exactly the same, so nothing in these overheads has changed, except for the field. So rather than using the real field, I'm just going to take the integers mod d. And here I'm only interested in d is equal to 2 and d is equal to 3. So the configuration space, every system has a position which is just drawn from the integers mod d. And the phase space is a set of positions and momenta, each of which are drawn from the integers mod d. And now the functionals are functions from the phase space to the integers mod d, and so on. The Poisson bracket has to be defined differently, because I can't use derivatives, as I did here. But you can just define a discrete version of the Poisson bracket. John Barrett is the one who urged me to do it this way, rather than just go straight to the symplectic inner product. So I hope this makes you happy, John. So the idea is you distort, you take the value of F at M translated in position, so the ith position translated, minus the value of the function at M, and this is a translation in momentum, minus translation in momentum, translation in position. And then in terms of that definition, if you look at the linear functionals, you find that this gives you precisely the symplectic inner product as before. So each of these functions, again, is associated with a vector. But now it's a vector in a dual space corresponding to the integers mod d. So this is a vector space over the integers mod d. I can still define a symplectic inner product on that space, the same way I did before. So just, you know, multiplication and addition now are all done modulo d. The only thing that's changed is the field. So again, you can have a notion of variables that have a Poisson bracket, zero or non-zero, and that's the same thing as looking at the symplectic inner product of the associated vectors. Okay, so this is all a bit abstract, but I'm going to get to pictures and examples shortly. I thought I would do the most general case first. So we now have this bilinear form on our functionals. So I can define a canonically conjugate pair of variables if their symplectic inner product is 1. So examples would be the position and the momentum of the first particle. They're canonically conjugate. And even if you look at a discrete system, if you look at their symplectic inner product, you find that indeed it's 1. Or the position and the momentum of the second particle, also canonically conjugate. And then you have others, like the sum of the positions of the two particles and the sums of the momenta. Those are also canonically conjugate pairs. You can also define a commuting pair of variables in terms of their Poisson bracket, or equivalently their symplectic inner product being 0. And so examples would be the position of the first particle and the position of the second particle, the position of the first and the momentum of the second, the difference in positions and the sums of the momenta, and so on. So here's the principle of classical complementarity. This is the axiom from which I'll be deriving things, is that an observer can only have knowledge of the values of a commuting set of canonical variables. And whereby commuting, I mean in terms of this Poisson bracket that's been introduced. So more precisely, if you have a commuting set S, the values of the variable in S are known perfectly, completely precisely, and the values of all the variables that are not in S are completely unknown. That's what I mean by this.
By no, you mean predictable, or?
No, I mean.
Sometimes you can't measure with a particular condition, so you can measure and the problem is predictable.
So, okay, you know, at time t, I know about the variables. There's something more precise to be said here, which is that at time t, an observer has knowledge about variables at time t prime later, which is limited in this way, right? So it is about prediction. To some extent, it's also about retrodiction, but it's not about pre and post selection, right? So this constraint does not apply if you have knowledge about a system, you know, preparing it and measuring it, and say, can I know something about its variables in between the preparation and the measurement? So that's a subtlety. Okay, and when you say in quantum mechanics, you know, we can't predict two different things. We're not in quantum mechanics here, we're in classical mechanics. I'm adding an axiom which is going to do precisely that. It's going to say you can't predict both position and momentum. Why? Because position and momentum don't form a commuting set of canonical variables, and therefore you can't know them simultaneously. Okay, so what are the valid states of knowledge given this principle? Well, they're specified by a set of known variables. So let me call that set script V. And for all the variables F and G in that set, the Poisson bracket is zero. So here's an example. I also have to specify a valuation of the known variables. If I know them, then I know their values. So there's some function V that goes from that set to either the reals or the integers mod D, depending on whether I'm looking at a continuous or discrete system. So for example, the position of the first particle might be found to be 2, and the momentum of the second particle might be 2. So this is a description in terms of variables. You can describe the same thing geometrically. So the set, remember, each of these variables was associated with a vector in the dual of the phase space. So that's a 2n dimensional vector space. And the Poisson bracket being zero was equivalent to the symplectic inner product of those guys being zero. If you have a set of vectors whose symplectic inner products are all zero, that's called an isotropic subspace. So here's a four-dimensional phase space. Position for particle 1, position for particle 2, momentum for 1 and 2. The subspace that's spanned by x1 and p2 is an isotropic subspace because these two variables commute. The subspace, the 2D subspace that's spanned by x1 and x2 is another isotropic subspace. Every one of these axes, any 1D subspace is also an isotropic subspace because the variable commutes with itself. So we now can have a geometric picture of these sets of variables, which is nice because if I give you a set of variables, if you start taking sums of those variables, you can form, you know, lots of sets that are all equivalent in terms of what they know. But if you draw it in terms of a subspace, it's a unique specification. And a valuation of the variables becomes a vector embedded within that isotropic subspace. So if I just think of this as a valuation of the variable f, right, I define this as a function. Well, again, by the Riet's representation theorem, there will be some vector v, which I denote exactly the same way as the functional, which, when I take the inner product with the transpose of f, will give me that value. So strictly speaking, v is in the phase space and f is in the dual space, but they're isomorphic to one another, so I'm going to draw them all in the same space. So here's v, and it assigns certain values to x1 and p2, the variables that are known. Is that clear? Sort of. All right. There's another way of characterizing what you know. So far I've been saying, let's characterize in terms of the variables whose values are known. We could also ask, what are the points in the phase space that are consistent with knowing what you know? So which are possible states that the system could be in? So here I'm going to use the term ontic states. These are not distributions over the space, but points in the state space. So what are the ontic states that are consistent with that knowledge? So they're all the M, the points of the phase space, such that F of M is just the value of F, right? So for all the variables that are in the known set, the value of that variable is given by V, this functional. So an epistemic state, a state of knowledge, is, as we just saw, maybe I should have been more precise about that, the epistemic states are parametrized by the isotropic subspaces and the vectors within those isotropic subspaces. So I have to give you a pair of things. I have to say, here's an isotropic subspace. That tells you the variables you know. And here's a vector within that subspace. That tells you the values that those variables take. And so we ask, what are the ontic states consistent with a particular subspace vector pair? And they're just these here. It turns out you can do a bit of manipulation on that. So this can be written in this vector notation as the inner product of F and M. And this is the inner product of F and V. But if I tell you that for a whole bunch of vectors, this inner product is the same as that, it's equivalent to saying that if I project that guy into the subspace V, I'll get the vector little v. And so this subspace here, I'm going to call V perp plus V. So what do I mean by that? Look at the picture. So here in this example, one knows x1 and x2, so that's your isotropic subspace. You have a vector v within that subspace that assigns particular values to x1 and x2. And what that means is that I have to assign a uniform distribution over the other variables. I know nothing about them. So my probability distribution over this 4D space is a plane which, when I project it into this 2D subspace, goes to this point here, the vector v, and is uniform over p1 and p2. So this plane is the space that's perpendicular to v, right? So if you just look at v perp, that's this plane here, p1, p2, and then translated by v, this valuation vector. So that means that the epistemic state associated with v and v can also be associated with this plane, which I've called v perp plus v. Those are all the ontic states consistent with that state of knowledge. And let me write it like this. The probability of phase space point M is just this delta function. If M belongs to this 2D plane, then it's 1. And if M does not belong, it's 0. And this is just a normalization factor so that when I integrate the probability distribution over all the phase space, I get 1. This is either a Dirac delta or a Kronecker delta, depending on whether I'm doing continuous or discrete. So maybe an example will be helpful. Suppose that x1 and x2 are the variables that are known, and their values are known to be 1 for the first and 2 for the second. Then this subspace here are the set of points in the phase space, such that x1 has a value 0 and x2, oh, that should have been 1. Actually, this should be 0, sorry. X1 of M is 0, X2 of M should be 2. So those are all the points that are 0 and 2 in these places. And the momentum of the first and second particles can be arbitrary, S and T. So it's the subspace parametrized in this way, and that's exactly what I've drawn here. Yes? Have I tried complex combination of what? If I did a complex, if I treated the pair of those observables as a complex number, I could represent the symplectic inner product as a regular product of complex numbers. But I don't think it would change the content of the theory. It would just be a different mathematical way of representing it. And I would say, again, the project here is let's not do any mathematical modifications unless there's a conceptual modification that goes along with it. So I wouldn't want to make these probabilities negative. Like, yes.
And so, but nonetheless, you can use AIM as a calculation. So you can do the same thing, except for plastic. And I think it's probably just that.
Because it sounds like you're just proposing a coordinate transformation, I don't see why the physical predictions would change at all. So one final note on this is that the characterization of your knowledge in terms of a distribution of the space is a bit like a Schrodinger picture. And the characterization of a set of variables and what values they have is like the Heisenberg picture. So I've just shown you those two ways of describing the knowledge. Okay, so what else do you need to describe the theory? So far I've only told you what kinds of probability distributions are allowed. You also have to know what sorts of transformations are allowed. If you ask what reversible transformations are allowed, the answer is just those that preserve the Poisson bracket or equivalently the symplectic inner product. And they're just the symplectic affine transformations, sometimes called the Clifford group. So if I have a point in the phase space, a symplectic affine transformation is a transformation of this form, where S is a matrix that preserves the symplectic inner product, and A is just another vector in the phase space which displaces you. So here's, there should be X's here. Here's an example, you know, a rotation in the phase space is a symplectic transformation, some translation in position momentum is an affine transformation. You can also talk about the non-reversible transformations, and you can characterize all of them, but I'm not going to go over it here. You can ask about the measurements that are allowed, consistent with the principle. So all along we're asking what should be allowed in this theory if this principle is going to be upheld. And it turns out any commuting set of canonical variables can be measured. If you demand that these measurements be reproducible, then the answer is any commuting set of canonical variables. That should sort of be obvious given the principle. But when you look at other measurements, there's more work to be done, and I'm not going to talk about it. But you can characterize all the measurements. So these are generalized measurements like POVMs. You can get all of them for this kind of theory. Okay, so that's it for the general presentation. That's the abstract way of looking at it. So now for some simple, easy to visualize examples. So I'll first consider the continuous case. So this is the theory of restricted Liouville mechanics. The phase space is just r to the 2n. And now I want to impose this epistemic restriction. So what do I get? Well, if I have a single degree of freedom, so position momentum, then my isotropic subspaces are just the 1D subspaces. So I can know the position. And it'll take some value. So if my valuation vector is this guy here, then I have a uniform distribution, which I've just drawn by this blue line. So I know exactly what the position is, but I know nothing about the momentum. Or I can know precisely what the momentum is and nothing about the position. But also, I could know some other quadrature, such as, you know, cos theta x plus sine theta p. So that would be this axis, which would be my isotropic subspace. And I have some I know the value of that variable, so that's some vector. And then what I know is basically a uniform distribution over the space orthogonal to it. So I know that my point in phase space lies somewhere here. Or finally, I could know nothing at all, in which case I just have a uniform distribution over the whole space. Similarly, if you go to a pair of systems, then it becomes harder to visualize because we have a four-dimensional phase space. But you just, you know, pick out isotropic subspaces. So here's one, knowing x1 and x2, find a vector in there, and you know, your knowledge will be a uniform distribution over the orthogonal space displaced by that vector. Here, you only know one variable, therefore your uniform distribution is over the other three variables. So it's a three-dimensional volume over which you have a uniform measure, and so on. Okay, that's the continuous variable case. Now, can we do the same thing for discrete systems? Let's look at the restricted statistical theory for TRITS, three-level classical systems. So there we just have a 2n-dimensional vector space over the integers mod 3. So the phase space for a single system, I'll draw it like this. It has three states for x and three states for p, or I should say three values, and three values here, therefore 9 ontic states in all. And now you can ask, what do the canonical variables look like for this system? And there's only limited ways of combining them, because A and B here have to take their values among the integers mod 3. So you can have x or 2x, but those amount to the same thing, whether you know x or 2x. So let's just call that, you know, one possible way of knowing x. You can know momentum. You can know the sum of x and p. Or you can know x plus 2p, which is equivalent to knowing x minus p. And that's it. Every other linear combination is some multiple of one of these four. So there are really only four ways of knowing about a single trip. And if you ask, well, what are the commuting sets of these guys? The answer is just the singleton sets. Every pair of these are canonically conjugate to one another. So you can only know one of them. Or you can know nothing at all. So let's take an example. Suppose you know that x is 0. Then you have a uniform distribution over the x is equal to 0 part of the phase space. Here are all the ways of knowing about a single trip. So here are the three ways you can know x. There's the three values x could take, the three ways of knowing about p. If you know x plus p, then this is modular arithmetic. So if I know x plus p is 0, then either they're both 0, or x is 1 and p is 2, or x is 2 and p is 1. And that's why I get this particular line in the discrete phase space. And similarly for x minus p. Or you could know nothing, in which case it's a uniform distribution over all the states. Okay, what about a pair of these three-level systems? So now my canonical variables are linear combinations of the position momenta for both of them. Again, those coefficients are drawn from the integers mod 3. So you have variables that are just about the first system, there's four of them, variables about the second system. But now you have some new variables that describe joint properties of the first and the second. So the sum of the position of the first and the second, or the sum of the position of the first and the momentum of the second, and so on. And now you can ask, well, what are the commuting sets? And it turns out that at most two of these sorts of variables can commute. Here are some examples, you know, position of first and the second, or something like this, the sum of the positions of the two and the difference of the momenta. These are all commuting sets. You could also know just one variable, or you can know nothing. So how do we draw this? We have to be a bit creative, because it's a lot harder to draw a four-dimensional phase space that's discrete. So what I do to make life easy is I take your two-dimensional phase space and I draw it out on a line, and then a four-dimensional phase space just can be represented in this two-dimensional Sudoku puzzle. Okay, so what's some examples? Suppose you only know one variable. Suppose you know the position of the first particle. Well, that's the position of the first particle is represented by whether you're in the first, second, or third row. And so you know that, say, x1 is equal to 0, so you're here in the 0th row. But you know nothing about the momentum of the first particle, so that'd be whether you're at 0, 1, or 2. And you know nothing about the position or the momentum of the second particle. Here, you know the momentum of the second particle, and you know it to be 0, so p2 is 0 along these three columns, so you have a uniform distribution over those guys. Suppose you know both these variables. So x1 and p2 commute. So I can know both of them. Well, I just have to take the intersection of those two probability distributions. And I'm left with this. This is like a product state in quantum theory, where I know the position of the first and the momentum of the second system. These are all the product states, or the product epistemic states in this toy theory. They map on, I should say, to all these stabilizer states of Q-trits, and I'll demonstrate that for you shortly. You can also have just one variable known. So here's a couple of examples where you know, for instance, these are non-local variables, or I should say joint variables between systems 1 and system 2. So if you know the difference in the positions of 1 and 2, then that corresponds to knowing that the sum of the positions is 0. That's all these ontic states. You can know the sum of the momenta. And if you know both of those things, then you just take the intersection. And you're left with this kind of state of knowledge, which is analogous to an entangled state in quantum theory. If you find out anything about the first system, you update your knowledge about the second system. And there's all the entangled states in this theory. And then you say, well, what are the symplectic affine transformations? They're just permutations of all these states in a phase space or a particular subset of the permutations. You can ask about the measurements, and they're just partitionings of these phase spaces into regions that correspond to valid epistemic states. So here's a few partitionings for one system, two systems. And you have a whole theory. Okay, that was the trick case. Maybe I don't think I'm going to go over the bit case, but it's exactly the same. You just have a phase space, two positions, two momenta, and it looks all the same. You have these kinds of states for pairs. These are your entangled states. Here are some transformations. Here are some measurements, and you're done. Okay, so now I have to prove to you that these three theories I just described are in fact equivalent to certain sub-theories of quantum theory. So let's start with the first one. I want to prove to you that restricted Liouville mechanics is the same as what I call quadrature quantum mechanics. So what is quadrature quantum mechanics? Well, we have Hermitian operators on R to the n. That's the definition of the commutator. I just look at the quadrature operators, which are the linear combinations of position momentum. And the quadrature states are going to be things that are eigenstates of a commuting set of quadrature operators. That's it. So quadrature quantum mechanics is the subset of states, valid quantum states, which are just the quadrature states, and the transformations and measurements that keep you within those quadrature states. And each of these, because of the discussion earlier, is associated with an isotropic subspace of my phase space and a vector within that space. So how do I know that this corresponds to the toy theory? All I have to do is look at the Wigner representation. That's the key. If you look at this subset of quantum theory, we want to compare it to a theory that's described on phase space. So let's use a representation of quantum states and measurements in phase space. And that's the Wigner representation. So the Wigner representation is defined as follows. You take the Weyl operators. You find the characteristic function in terms of the expectation value of those guys. And you take the symplectic Fourier transform of that characteristic function to get Wigner. It's not so important. I won't show you the proof, but if you look at all those quadrature eigenstates, I mean, you can sort of see it, that if you were to draw a picture of them in phase space, it's not surprising that the Wigner functions correspond to exactly the pictures I drew before. So what we've shown, well, I haven't really proven it to you, I've just sort of stated it, but what one can show is that restricted Liouville mechanics is empirically equivalent to quadrature quantum mechanics. What about the trick theory? Yes? That's right, you can. So there's nothing non-local or non-contextual about the original ETR paradox. Okay, so for the three-level systems, it's more complicated. Because we don't have a set of observables that are like Q and P and Q plus P. Yes? That's right. Because the... So the important thing maybe that could be confusing is that Bell inequality violations are not the same as the original EPR paradox. Maybe that's what's troubling you. Okay, so I see my time has kind of flown by. So let me try to do the trick case. As I said, we don't have operators that have the canonical commutation relations if I'm looking at a three-level system. So we have to do things differently. So first let me show you a different way of presenting that theory I described, this restricted classical theory. So remember, we had isotropic subspaces, and that corresponded to uniform distributions over orthogonal spaces. Now, define the space which I get by taking the vectors in that isotropic space and multiplying them by that symplectic matrix. And all that does is it basically says find the vectors which are canonically conjugate to the vectors in V. So in this example, where V is just x1, the canonically conjugate variable is p1. So my subspace M is just p1. And now note that if I translate all the support of my distribution by vectors inside M, I get the distribution back again. I can translate along this axis, and it doesn't change my distribution. So you can think of this as a classical stabilizer, right? All these transformations leave my distribution invariant. And so you can, roughly speaking, characterize what you know in terms of subspaces that stabilize your probability distribution. It turns out that you can, I won't go through this little proof here, but this orthogonal complement to a subspace V is equivalent to something called the symplectic complement of the subspace M. So I can talk about my epistemic states as being parameterized by M and V now, where M is my stabilizer subspace. And then it's just a delta function on the subspace symplectic complement of M translated by V. Okay, so this is just another way of describing the same thing, and this is what I can show comes out of quantum theory, exactly these kinds of distributions, if I move to a discrete Wigner representation of my quantum states. Okay, I don't want to do all this. the point is this, that there's a discrete analog of the Weyl operator. You can define a discrete analog of boosts and shifts along your finite phase space, and you can define a Weyl operator for multiple systems if you want. Great. Then it turns out, this is just a definition of what the stabilizer formalism for Qutris is. They're a set of states which are basically eigenstates of these Weyl operators. So this rho is the normalized projector onto the joint eigenspace of a bunch of Weyl operators. So if I take an isotropic subspace that defines a whole bunch of Weyl operators that it turns out can be simultaneously diagonalized, and I ask for a state which is stable under all those guys. All those translations leave the state invariant. That's why it's called a stabilizer state. And so I specify the operators for which my state is a joint eigenstate, and I specify the eigenvalues, and I'm done. I've specified a stabilizer state. So again, because the eigenvalues are associated with a vector V, and because the eigenspaces are associated with an isotropic subspace M, all my stabilizer states are associated with a subspace and a vector. And finally, you can show that there's a way of defining a discrete Wigner function such that the discrete Wigner function of that state is precisely the distribution that I had in my restricted statistical theory. So all the hard work here was done, originally there's a long tradition of discrete Wigner representations, but recently there's this very important paper by Gibbons, Hoffman, and Wooters. And building on that and slightly modifying these definitions, David Gross came up with a definition of a Wigner function, which I'm using here. So I highly recommend this paper. It's insightful. Okay, so I've shown that my theory is equivalent to the stabilizer theory for Qutris. So, great. It seems so easy now, you would probably think, right, so you're just going to do the same thing for qubits. And you'll find that it's exactly the same as the stabilizer theory for qubits. Not the case. These two theories are actually slightly different. And I won't go into it. You can certainly define stabilizers for qubits. You can define a discrete Wigner function exactly analogously to the way I just did. But you find that the Wigner functions for qubit stabilizer states sometimes go negative. And it all has to do with the fact that a symplectic vector space over the integers mod 3 is fundamentally different from a symplectic vector space over the integers mod 2. That difference between 2 and 3 is what accounts for the Wigner function going negative here.
Well, let me ask
you
this question. Is it just even odd?
I think it is even odd, yeah. I'm not sure I can give you a better mathematical answer.
I guess what I'm asking is
Does it happen in form? So, I don't precisely remember what Gross does in his paper. My recollection until recently was that you can do it for any even dimension or any odd dimension, and you find the same feature. But looking at the paper recently, I suddenly started wondering whether actually D had to be a prime. And so I'm unclear on what the answer to your question is. I know there's a lot of work in discrete Wigner functions where it's important that D is a prime. But for Gross's work, I'm currently unclear as to whether that's important or not.
stop you from getting in touch with the picture, the same principle of developing the same idea for arbitrary time dimensions, arbitrary hours.
So I think there's certainly no obstacle to other primes, and I think there's no obstacle to any D. But that's what I'm not sure about. It depends on Gross's construction. Yes. Well, I'm coming to that very point. Okay. So the conclusion here is that the restricted statistical theory of bits is not equivalent to the stabilizer theory for qubits, but they are very close. It turns out that the group of transformations you can do in one and the other are exactly the same. In a sense, the restricted statistical theory of bits is about as close as you could get to the stabilizer theory for qubits while still being local and non-contextual. I won't go over this. Chancellor, I've already spoke about this yesterday. There's a difference in the kinds of correlations you can have when you measure mutually unbiased bases on both sides of a bipartite system. And the restricted statistical theory, always has an odd number of correlations, whereas quantum theory always has an even number of correlations. And that's one of the ways in which these two things are distinct. Another way in which they're distinct is that in the qubit stabilizer theory, you do have Bell inequality violations and proofs of contextuality. For example, the GHZ proof. It's not a partial transpose qubit, but it's a bit like that. Certainly, these correlations would lead you to think, oh, it's just a partial transpose. But it's more subtle still because it's the difference between locality and non-locality. And Bob is going to talk about this later this week, so you'll hear more about this distinction between these two theories. I guess that's the answer to your earlier question. Stay tuned for Bob's talk. Okay, so Michael, the question you asked was, could we get coherent states? The more general question is, could a different statistical restriction get us closer to quantum theory in any of these cases, coherent states, or maybe even closer still? And the answer is no for the two-level and three-level systems. There's no way a different statistical restriction will get us close to quantum theory. Why? Because if you take the unitary representation of the Clifford group, these symplectic affine transformations, and you add any other unitary that's outside that, you close it and you get all the unitaries. So there is no other group that contains the Clifford group and is a subgroup of the full unitary group. So as I see it, the next stop is quantum theory. You're not going to find better epistemic restrictions that'll get you halfway there. Yeah. Right. True. So the question here is, can you derive that subset of quantum theory? And implicit here, I'm saying, can you have an epistemic restriction? And what you imagine is that all of your different epistemic states, there'll be reversible transformations between all of them. That was a feature that all of these theories had. Can you expect such a theory, to build such a theory, and have it have a group of transformations between Clifford and the full unitary group? No, you can't. So I agree that you can find other subsets of quantum theory that'll have local hidden variable models, but you can't build them in this sort of way. So it's no for the discrete degrees of freedom, but the answer for the continuous degrees of freedom is yes, you can go further. Because in addition to the rotations and displacements in phase space, which is all I had in my quadrature theory, you can add squeezing operations. And that corresponds to actually having all quadratic Hamiltonians. So there is a group between the one I was describing and the full unitary group. Well, I mean, maybe it depends on what you mean by closer to quantum theory. So if I built a new toy theory that had the following feature, it's not closed under reversible transformations. I can't get from one epistemic state to any other by a reversible transformation. That's a sense in which that theory would be unlike quantum mechanics. So in a sense, this new theory would be less similar to quantum mechanics than the theories I've just written down. It would have a feature that these theories don't have. Maybe it would be closer in other respects. That's possible. Yeah. Okay, so the answer to the coherent state question is yes, you can do it, and this is still unpublished work. I had a couple of slides about it, but I'm just going to skip them. Maybe, Michael, I can tell you about this later. There's a different kind of epistemic restriction that'll get you there. Okay, so I've gone over time. Why don't I had some more to say about other epistemic restrictions, but I'm going to stop and for questions, and if people happen to want to ask me about this, then that's fine. But I'm not going to presume that you want to hear about it. Thanks for your attention. Yes?
So I think if you have any pure Gaussian space, the big one is you have a Gaussian vector function, then then you can write down an operator that's not summation, but it is it's some complex combination of x and t. And when you act on that state, it gives you zero. So you know if it doesn't mean zero, then you can whatever the center is. And together with the measurement results, as well as the numbers, the complex amplitudes, give you complete Gaussian. I'm pretty sure that you use complex combination and just said, forget what it means. Forget I know where the particle is, or I know the momentum, but I know the combination x1 plus i c1.
But that's no different. If I say I know x1 plus ip1, that's no different from saying I know x1 and I know p1.
Well, it depends on what you consider complementary, because I'm saying that you don't know x1 exactly, and you don't know p1 exactly, but you do know the combination x1 plus ip1.
But there's an I there, so if you give me a complex number, I can always extract its real and its imaginary part.
Well, this is why I think it may entail that I know the real function. But nevertheless, it works mathematically. So if you define the complementary variable properly. So for a stable system, it's just like saying A acting on the ground state is zero. Everyone knows that. A acting on the parent state is delta. So if you can define a sweet A that acts on sweet A, you can center that. So you can do all this to sort of stabilize a formalism with complex numbers, and you get all the Gaussian space. There was a problem with space too. The question is, what are the variables that you can't have? And what is the ones that don't need it? So
it's not clear to me whether what you have in mind is just a different coordinate choice, just different convention from what I'm doing here. What I'll say is this, that although I just sort of breezed through it in the last couple of slides, you can get all the coherent states without introducing complex coordinates. Instead of saying, I know a commuting set of canonical variables, you basically write down a version of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Here's the covariance matrix. You put a constraint on the covariance matrix, and you can get all of them. So I can certainly get where you're saying you'd like to go. I don't see why I need to use complex numbers to do it.
Because what you said was that you can get only quadrant transcendence, you mean
that's
right. So by doing this, by allowing, see what you did before, you said the real and imaginary parts are independent.
Yeah.
So I can't know them both. If I'm the real part of Gaussian, then I don't know the imaginary part.
Right. Right.
So what I'm saying is that those are extreme cases of saying that that B and B star are complementary. It works. I'm going to show you that. But it does work. It's like saying you don't know where the plane is.
Okay. Well, let's talk about it later. So yeah.
It's possible to simulate different operations and Gaussian operations particularly. I guess the way you can do it is subtracting the effect or if you just sort of did a simulation of the classical dynamics of the underlying your theory, how would that relate to the standard approach? Is it somehow the same, and is it a different order? Even if not, is it the same way as the efficient? And it's very,
It's a really good question, and I should have thought more about it. Given a bit of thought to it, and my original inclination was to think, surely I could sort of rederive the Gaussman-Knill theorem by saying, let me just do a simulation using this classical description. But that turns out not to be obviously the case. I don't know whether you can or not, but it wasn't obvious when I thought about it. Yeah, no, clearly you can simulate it efficiently. The question is more, could you come up with a proof of why you could simulate it efficiently, wherein sort of the reason was that, well, because it admits a local non-contextual hidden variable model, that's why you can simulate it efficiently. If we had a proof of that flavor, it would be quite nice. Is it obvious? I guess I have to know, I mean, computational complexity arguments aren't my forte, so you may be right that it is obvious. It's just not obvious to me.
I mean, that's right. We're in the original simple toy theories, and each of the toy bits is two classical bits. So n of them is two n classical bits. We saw that an operation which only acts on a subset of the n toy bits, so then we change the subset of the two n bits to the story. We change them to go.
That answer your question, Howard? Right, so there'll be, right. What you really want is sort of an extra unitary relative to the set that you already have. And when you add that, incidentally, I should say that if you take Gaussian quantum mechanics, you can't violate a Bell inequality or have a Cauchy-Specker argument, which is critical for this result because you're starting with a local non-contextual hidden variable model. So it's probably also true that if you just add anything to Gaussian quantum mechanics, like, you know, one extra unitary besides those that are in the group, all of a sudden you get Bell inequality violations in contextuality. I would expect that to be the case. So you wouldn't be able to get there from this sort of approach. You would need that extra insight into, you know, what more do I have to add to get the other quantum phenomena, the hard ones.
Yeah, doing
I think that's right. It could be that so my best guess as to what has to go is the notion of intrinsic properties. The hidden variable framework and the framework I've been using here says it makes sense to talk about a system and its properties. But if that doesn't make sense, and the only sense in which a system has properties is relative to everything else in the universe, then you're in a very different framework. And the idea that, you know, which apparatus you bring up to a system could make a difference, it seems more natural. I mean, the way we currently do it, we say, it has some properties, whether I bring this apparatus up to it, or whether I bring this other apparatus up to it. But now if I say, all properties are relational, then there's nothing that's necessarily that's unchanged between the first situation and the second situation, because the rest of the universe has changed. That's meant to be very vague and speculative, but I can't do any better than that currently. Yep. I don't feel like it. Yeah. Well, up until a couple of days ago, I would have sort of said confidently, these results generalize to even dimensions. You know, for the even dimensional cases, you'll get something slightly different from the quantum. And for all the odd dimensional cases, you'll get something exactly equivalent. Because that was my recollection. So I'm leaning heavily on David Gross's work. And a year ago when I read it, I was convinced of that. But just a couple of days ago, my confidence was shaken, and so I'm no longer certain of that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is. That's right, yeah. It's entirely plausible that Einstein had this kind of hidden variable theory in mind when he constructed the EPR example. Right. So you could have a different kind of drawing. You know, I had the left and the right column of things you get in classical theories with a statistical restriction and things you don't. You could say, you know, you could have two columns, things you get in generic operational theories and things that aren't so generic. And I think those, those would be quite different because, you know, Bell inequality violations appear to be generic among operational theories. So it has to do with where you're starting from. So from an operational framework perspective, you would say, well, what's special about quantum mechanics is not Bell inequality violations, because lots of theories have them. We have to figure out, you know, what sets it apart in this operational landscape. And the project here is more, let's not have an operational landscape. Let's start with an ontological landscape. I don't really have many points in this landscape. I started with the classical theory. I added an epistemic restriction, and I got a new kind of theory. I have a landscape that has at least 2 points in it. So maybe there's a few more we can come up with. And in that landscape, you say, well, what distinguishes quantum mechanics is the fact that it has Bell inequality violations and contextuality. But it shares features like no broadcasting and teleportation with other points on this landscape.
Convex theories that are going to be sort of used as predictions of classical theory are almost always going to have to probably always sort of violate that assumption that we've used in a lot of our work just in order to get the kind of classical underlying model. So that may be where, you know, a lot of sort of different rules are coming
Yes. My pleasure. Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, but if you, so I don't think it lives naturally in this convex framework because it's not closed under convex domination. But maybe you could define an analog of it in a more restricted framework that has a notion of partial convex domination. I should add that there is a sense in which these two categorizations do have a similar implication, which is that anybody who's working on reconstruction and has written down some axioms against a mathematical framework in the background should look at the left-hand sides of both these kinds of lists and say, are my axioms on the left-hand side? Because if so, then there's a whole lot more work being done by that mathematical framework than I thought was being done. So, you know, the Clifton-Boob-Halverson result in the C-star algebraic formulation starts with no signaling, no broadcasting, no bit commitment, and derives quantum theory. And then when you find that actually in operational theories in general, the three axioms are generic, and in these restricted classical theories, those three axioms are generic, suddenly you realize, well, it must be the C-star algebra assumption that's doing most of the work in pinpointing quantum theory. So I would say, but...
This.
Yeah. And the reason they give is, well, all known empirically successful theories can be formulated with a C-star algebra, to which I think the response should be, the project here is to start with the biggest possible landscape, not the smallest possible landscape. Sure. No. I guess it seemed like a reasonable response at the time, but you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I would say you know the fact that something was empirically successful doesn't count for much in this sort of program. Yeah, I think it does. there's a sense in which if you knew the ontic state, you know, if you violate the restriction here, that's a resource. You can do stuff with that. You can be a more powerful eavesdropper in a key distribution scheme than you can be otherwise. And similarly, if you imagine a theory wherein PR boxes are allowed, but there's a restriction that takes you down to quantum theory, then I think it would have the same sort of flavor that relaxing that restriction could be considered a resource, and you could work out that resource theory.
I think